Hoot, hello! Welcome to another episode of Spilling Lavender Tea and Seeding Cheese with Kate and Teacher Mads.
Hello, hello! It's so great to be back. It's been a bit of a pause.
Our sabbatical? I don't know.
just need to get our lives together just for a hot sec.
Just for a minute.
But we are so excited to be making another episode. We are still outside of Canada.
We're still outside of Canada.
Which I'm very, very excited about.
I love this for us.
And we are traveling to
New Zealand.
New Zealand.
With our favorite Maori cat auntie.
Yes. The second we come on FaceTime, you're like, show me the cat. Like, 1 second.
Priorities.
Yeah. So without further ado, if you want to introduce yourself, that would be great.
Yeah, kia ora koutou, hi everyone, I guess, who might be listening. Ko ai au, ko kaurana ki tōku maunga, ko tukituki tōku ao, ko takitimu tōku waka, ko Ngāti Kangunu, ko Rohomai Wahine, ko Rangitāne o Kuiwi, ko Whatui Apiti Raua, ko Ngāti Hāwe o Kuhapu, ko India Mero Logan Riley. So yeah, my name's India. And yeah, that's just how we introduce ourselves. We always like geolocate ourselves in like a long order of like our mountain and our river, our oceans, the ancestral canoe, double-hulled canoe that we sailed on from the Pacific to Aotearoa or New Zealand on, and then like our nation and our confederation and our village and all those kinds of things. So you gotta say everything else that's way more important than you before you say your own name. But then that way it's cool because when you meet other people, you share that, and then they'll be like, oh yeah, my auntie grew up there, or oh, my family's from the same waka, the same canoe, or something like that. So that's kind of like the whole point of that, is like you start to bind yourself immediately through those ancestral relationships. But yeah, just to explain that, but yeah, my name's India Mero Logan Riley. So yeah, I come from the nations of Whatui Apiti and Ngāti Hāwe, which falls under a broader kind of confederation called Ngāti Kahungunu. We all descend from the same person who just like had lots of relationships called Kahungunu. So that's why he gets his name on the confederation. And then, yeah, also have ancestral ties to other nations on the east coast of the North Island of Aotearoa, Rongo Mai Wahine and Rangitāne. It's all very close and very neighbourly to each other. So, yeah, we're all quite tied by ancestry. Yeah, what else about myself? I do climate change campaigning, have been doing that for a really long time now, or it feels like a long time, both like locally, we're talking like blockades, land occupations, but then also like UN stuff and lobbying and policy and all that really, really fun stuff. But actually my academic background's in archaeology, and that's what I originally studied and hope to one day return to once we've sorted out climate change and colonization. It should be really doable, right? Yeah, just do it. Yeah, I'm the eldest of five children. They are why I do what I do. And yeah, that's pretty much it. A cat parent of one cat, plus others who just come in and feed themselves. We're figuring that out. Yeah, that's me, I think.
I feel like we feel like that with youth. They just come in, they feed themselves.
It is. Good when they get independent, but yeah. It's not good when they won't go home.
Yeah. Like, where's your family?
Yeah. Go home.
Carry them two doors down, back to their house.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm so happy to see you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, been a minute.
We think about the Paloma.
Yeah.
All the time.
Oh my gosh.
The Paloma? The Pavlova.
The Pavlova.
Paloma, a drink?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I do need a drink.
If I made you guys drink, and you like it, you're like, great. Yes.
Sorry, the Pavlova.
Yeah, the Pavlova. Yes, the giant meringue with berries and cream.
So good.
Our national summer dish for potlucks, which is also the same time as Christmas here, so it's like a very Christmas cake thing. Yeah,
so good.
That's so much better than what we do here with like Christmas loaf. What am I thinking of?
You're thinking fruitcake. Yeah, fruitcake.
Fruitcake. Yeah.
No, hard pass.
You folks do it better.
Yeah.
The real berries.
Yeah.
Not this fake berry thing. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
All right. All right.
We've been on a roll this week. Just saying things at the exact same time.
Yeah. It's not. It's fun, but also not fun.
Especially when we're trying to play rock, paper, scissors. It went on forever. India, it was horrific.
We ended up having Indian food that night. So that's how we came down to it.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So long as it resolved itself, right? Eventually.
Yeah. In tears, but we got it. but we're really excited to be able to chat with you. We've obviously, the Maori is, a lot of, we get a lot of our, my brain will load.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to follow and, you guys are very great leaders in,
mm-hmm.
revitalization and everything like that and upholding culture. And I know, a lot of Indigenous, groups around the globe have kind of looked towards the Maori to what are they doing, this is something that we could be doing, mm-hmm. and things like that. So we're really excited to kind of get to hear the whole scope and from somebody that actually lives it. So we're gonna get started with our fun questions that we ask everybody. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of already explained your nation and where you're from, but we would love to know what your personal experience is, or if you're able to speak to your community's experience with colonization.
Yeah, cool. It was a whole history lesson in a short window. I think it's important, before I guess I talk about the dark times, to talk about what it was like before.
Mm-hmm.
The colonizers showed up and before the British Empire mm-hmm. showed up, and to talk a little bit about the landscape of where I'm from, because I think that informed a lot of how colonization played out. And there are lots of different stories. Each of our nations, or iwi as we call them, have different stories of how we came to be on those islands. But I'm from a particular part which is named Te Mata o Māui, or the Hook of Māui. And everyone knows Māui from Moana. Yeah. Well, we won't dive into the politics of Disney and Indigenous stories. basically, his big hook that he has, that's what he used to fish up the island, the North Island, as it's called under English names, or, Te Ika o Māui, or the Fish of Māui, in our language. And so the curve of the bay that we sit in is the shape of the hook,
mm-hmm.
and that was made from the hook as it was pulled up. So that ties us into a history of the Pacific, because there's that very direct physical relationship. Hawke's Bay, where I'm from, or Te Mata o Māui, is this bountiful, incredible place that was settled very early on by Māori and was made a home by our Pacific ancestors. Only quite recently, and kind of history of humans, about 700, 800 years ago, that we know. But also there are stories of people being born of the land who just grew out of the land, and those can be true at the same time. But of course, that's part of a bigger voyaging legacy where, our ancestors were traveling across the Pacific using just the stars and the currents and the animals before the pyramids were even being built. So mm-hmm. it's this long reaching big family, I guess, and that still informs a lot of our politics today in Aotearoa. And so it's this beautiful place where I come from, where there are these flat plains, quite small. New Zealand's small, we're quite condensed. You can ski and surf in the same day. It's very compacted, even though there's lots of different landscapes. So we've got these flat plains that have these four rivers that would weave through them, and lots of little harbours and estuaries and wetlands ringed on three sides by mountains, where there is tectonic activity. We've got hot springs and stuff like that, so we sit in that ring of fire as well. And then the fourth side is the Pacific Ocean, is the big bay, and we face right out into the ocean. There's nothing between my coastal area and that big piece of the world, that big piece of water. It's this really incredible place with beautiful weather and very bountiful, and that's part of why we we ended up living there. And then, of course, that's also why other people wanted to live there, why British settlers wanted to live there. And so, yeah, our first encounter, I guess, with colonizers was Abel Tasman back in the 1600s. So I think that's also part of the context, is like colonization arrived to us later than it did for other parts of the world. And that informed a lot of how the British Empire treated us and their tactics and strategies, because they'd learned from the other colonizing elsewhere, really dark and morbid. And then we had one of the kingpins of colonization, Captain Cook, show up nearly 100 years later, and that set off a chain reaction that, yeah, we continue to live with today. And even in his first time of being in those islands, he started renaming parts of my landscape because of his encounters with my ancestors. So there was a fight, some of his crew got kidnapped, and so, like, the place that's just 10 minutes drive down the road from my mum's house where I lived as a kid has got renamed Cape Kidnappers, and that's what it's been in the maps and the geography ever since. And so there's, like, yeah, there's a rewriting of landscapes and names and our legacies even right from the very beginning of that person, Captain Cook. Horrible, horrible man. And so, yeah, and then I think it's really important to acknowledge, like, the empires within Europe had decided they didn't want to fight in their homelands as much because it was really violent and really awful. So they took that battle to elsewhere and fought over territories elsewhere. And so when settlers, European settlers, we call them Pākehā, like white, non-Māori, started coming, it was like, oh, it was for economic opportunity. It was for, you know, poor and working class British people to be able to make some money so they could break free from their class oppression back home in the UK and the monarchy and all of that. And so a lot of, like, whalers and sealers were coming over. I know it's very similar to over on the coast in your guys' way as well. And there was, like, a lot of trade between Australia and Aotearoa too. And Māori were really quick to jump on, like, economics and trade and getting really into that and, like, recognizing the opportunity of that. What we didn't anticipate as much was, like, the violence and the land dispossession that would come with that. It was very, like, trusting, maybe naively so, but there were attempts to ask the British government to take care of their people here because they started misbehaving. They were getting drunk, they were spreading disease around, like syphilis, they were fighting with each other, they weren't following our laws. So we're like, hey, you need to come in and sort your people out. Just like when I go overseas, I'm not just my own person, I represent my nation. And I've got to be on good behavior, right? These people had not learned that. They're like, freedom from the UK.
Bad manners.
We'll do what we want. Yeah, real bad manners. There was some, like, and it was very nuanced. It's always very nuanced around the country of each nation as well, that, you know, some of my ancestors had quite good relations and were invited to live there, but under the governance and under the, like, ongoing sovereignty of the nations here, of the Māori nations here. So, yeah, just depended on which part of the country you were in. But I guess more specifically in Hawke's Bay, it wasn't so much the big land wars like what happened in other parts of the country, although that did influence the legal complexities that the Crown decided to bring to taking our land. It was a lot of, like, very coercive and underhanded land purchases in quotation marks, because we didn't have a concept of being able to sell land. You can't own land, you belong to it. So it's very different. What we understood was happening was these were more kind of like exchanges in order for these people to be allowed the privilege of being on the land while still remaining under the governance and sovereignty of our rangatira, our chiefs, and under that decision making. It wasn't like you could cut your parcel off and then do whatever you want, like it is under, like, private property structure. So that got really complicated after a bit, and what ended up happening in that process was we signed a treaty with the Crown. Treaties, great thing. It's a whole topic. But it also was informed by the Crown wanted to come in and sign a treaty because France was sniffing around Aotearoa as well. So they're like, oh no, we can't have France one-upping us in this ego empire battle. But also they'd figured out that genocide was really expensive and resource intensive.
Mm-hmm.
So like all out, like you see in the archives, they're talking about like, oh yeah, it's cheaper to assimilate rather than outright destroy.
Mm-hmm.
Learning from what they'd done, and especially in Australia and in Africa and in India and also in the Americas and stuff like that. So they're like, we're going to sign a treaty and we will make the brown soul white that way, is the approach. And so in 1840, a bunch of chiefs signed a treaty. Not all chiefs signed the treaty, so some parts of Aotearoa do not fall under that treaty. But post kind of colonization, we have acquired an amalgamated Māori identity, but it was much more kind of like unique to where you're from before that. It was more like, there's a lot more international relations going on the same island before the Crown showed up. But the treaty was like not awful. So it was like basically the Queen gets to maintain her right to govern her people here, right? She needs to take care of them. But Māori retain our tino rangatiratanga, so our sovereignty and our self-governance. The second article talks about how like we maintain our rights to and our ownership of our forests, oceans, lands, and taonga, or treasures.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes our more than human relatives and that kind of thing. And it also says that the Crown gets first right of refusal to buy land. So we can't sell privately to just randoms. It has to go through the Crown, which I think is an interesting choice. That, yeah, there's probably lots of more legal academic research on like why that was the way it was. And then the third article says that affirms the rights of Māori to be protected by the Crown and to be afforded the rights of British citizenship and the privileges that came with that. And then there's like an oral fourth article that talks about a right to freedom of religion and cultural practice. You can tell whether these were like adhered to or not. Newsflash, they weren't. Crown broke all the rules. Mm-hmm. We're still battling that. So in Hawke's Bay, originally they're like, yeah, we want to keep buying land. But the chiefs started to have a lot of problems with rogue chiefs going off and selling land to the Crown that wasn't theirs to sell, and, you know, those kinds of complexities, even though we're not even selling land because that culturally doesn't make sense. So the chiefs ended up, like, coming together and being like, we're not selling land anymore. We're not doing this anymore. They wrote to, like, the governor and other representatives of the British Empire and said, no, we're not doing it. Can't make us, you know. Screw this. It's not good for our people.
Yeah.
And then what ended up happening was they introduced a bunch of other laws that then turned the ownership of land into individual titles. So we couldn't collectively own land anymore. You could only have up to 10 owners, and that was determined by a British court. So they would pick their favorites who they knew would sell them land and put them on the list of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Because Māori were starting to lease land, and this is in the archives, they're like, leasing is the worst thing for the colonial project because that means we can't take it. So we need to get rid of leasing. And so they said you could only lease to the Crown, and they made private leasing illegal as well.
You know, like your land to us.
Because we in Hawke's Bay were hearing about these other land movements around the country to stop the taking of land, that's also like strengthened the resolve to not sell land and to be really staunch about that. And then because of what was happening, there were these really big land wars happening in Taranaki and the Waikato that were really awful, really violent. You know, I'm not going to go into it, but there is, of course, like the story of Parihaka, which is where nonviolent resistance was kind of born here, and the horrors of that. I mean, everyone will know who understands Indigenous history anyway. It gets really awful and really violent and really deadly. So we're like, nah, we're not doing that. And then, yeah, this like individual title got introduced, and then just like pieces and pieces and pieces were carved off. But it happened really quickly, and I think that's the difference in terms of colonization here, is that in my region we lost about 70% of our land within about 6 years.
Wow.
So really quick. And if you think about New Zealand's small, with some small islands, that's like a lot of land gone. So we didn't really have land to retreat to or go hide in anymore, particularly because of like the geography of our landscapes as well, these beautiful flat plains. And so that was pretty much it by the end of it. And then there was that one large land block left, and then lots of coercive sneaky dealings and backdoor dealings and stuff like that, and going through British courts. And so what we're ultimately left with now is the Karamu land block, which is where one of my marae sits. It's where my grandma lives. And it is just, a few tens of acres, and that's pretty much it. And then also what happened was, because their wetlands and their riverways and stuff like that, a lot of that got drained. So like our food, what we call our food cupboards. So the places where we would gather our food or hunt fish and that kind of thing were drained and turned into farmland as well. And I think that's the main thing that also differentiates New Zealand from other places in the empire, is that we were to generate food for the rest of the empire. And that the ideals of like the poor and working class people who came here was so that they could achieve a kind of landed gentry aristocrat lifestyle. They have their patch of land with their house, and that's it. And so that like imagined ideal world got transplanted here. And so the majority of stolen land here is farmland, and a lot of that now is dairy, and so that's why like half of our emissions come from agriculture. It's because of that legacy there. There is oil and those resources here, but it's mostly like food, dairy, like milk powder is like one of our main exports.
Interesting.
Yeah, this is one anyway. And then like forestry as well. And that's a big one on the coast where I'm from, is it all like the nearest patch of native forest is like an hour and a half, 2 hour drive away. And that's second growth. That's not old growth.
Oh my gosh.
And so, yeah, completely decimated in order to maintain the rest of the empire. And then I think the other interesting piece here is, like, you know, I talked earlier about names and renaming places. Napier, Hastings, Clive and Havelock, which are like the four main cities and like villages in my region, are all named after guys who did really good colonizing in India. So that was the legacy in terms of like the timeline of colonization, was after you did really good colonizing in India, you'd be rewarded with a patch of land in New Zealand. And so they had these like India man colonies to entrench the presence of the empire here, while also rewarding them for being really awful somewhere else.
Some terrible positive reinforcement.
So our best land, our best locations with the best weather all became these like colonial sites that we're still battling with today. And that's like, you can see it in, you know, the legacies of like the pollution and stuff like that, where like ultimately in our governance structures that never would have been allowed to happen, but yeah, it was enabled through big time violence and the crown. I think that's the summary for now.
Oh my gosh, that's wild.
They just keep getting trickier and trickier. They're sneaky.
They've learned.
They learned. And that's the thing, I think there's this, one of my arch nemesis, this guy, George Grey, who was one of the key colonial figures in the empire. So he was stationed in New Zealand twice. He was stationed in Australia. He was stationed in South Africa as their like the crown's governor, and he literally wrote the handbook on how to colonize and assimilate. So he wrote his 3 points: you employ them under European employees, right, so bring them into a like capitalist workforce. You send the kids off to white schools, right? We know that there's like a familiar one.
Sounds familiar.
And then break their land down into individual title. And so he wrote that, and then he sent that back to the crown in London, and then they disseminated that strategy to elsewhere in the empire. This guy.
This guy.
Oh my god.
This time machine. When I get sorted out. Hey, best believe.
I'm coming for you, buddy.
There's a statue of him in the park next to the university I went to, and it's like, aww, every time I'd walk past it, I'd be like, you, he's my enemy. His head's been taken off a couple times.
Nice. Good.
Yeah, there's a whole battle happening around that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's nutty. I can't. I don't think it's ever going to not surprise me how, like, creepy, crawly, fast colonialism
honestly though
runs. It's like a big, scary spider for me, personally.
Ew.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah.
So mean to spiders.
I know. They're very important, but they really scare me.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's so just like, I mean, I was reading the other day, it's also about how here they, you know, instead of genocide, it was domicide. So like the removing of people's homes. Mm-hmm. And you, when you create a homeless class, then you can create like exploitative working conditions just to use them for their labor. And I'm just like, oh God, so layered, right? Yeah. And so insidious and really hard to then undo. Because that, like, didn't just remake physical worlds, it remade cultural worlds as well.
It's that whole idea of, like, identity is so tied to the lands, and then as you start taking the land away, like, that's when you start losing who you are as a people, and then when those lands are so altered that you can't even get them back to where they were, like, how do you actually reconnect and, like, have that?
How do you recognize yourself anymore?
So,
Still
makes my skin crawl. Yeah.
And it is like in the context of the Pacific, they also took our ocean, right? Mm-hmm, like the idea of the existence of international waters or the high seas or whatever is an erasure of indigenous governance of those places. Yep. And I think like even for us being from the coast is like our terrain doesn't end where the like coast is. It keeps extending all the way back to, all across the Pacific and over to where you guys are as well, that's ours and it's ours to take care of. And then you've got entities like the UN or America being like, oh, no, this is belongs to no one, therefore we can do what we want.
Sketchy.
You're like, it's not even like trying to claim it as ours because like this is ours, but it's like we're supposed to be taking care of it.
Yeah.
It's pretty much it. Like, just please don't ruin it.
Yeah.
God damn it.
Yeah.
And look what happened. The world is melting. But I know that despite all of the awful things that have happened and that, like, there is some things that can never be recovered, but there is a lot of work that has been done and I know a lot of good that's happened in a short period of time. What are some key things that you could tell us about that has been to reclaim culture?
It's such a hard one. I think there are like certain, I guess, like political battle sites that were chosen, and I think sometimes that came at the cost of others, or there are other areas around even like I think a lot, I've been thinking a lot about like our, you know, like prior to colonization we possibly had like at least 5 different genders and stuff like that, and like that's, we've lost those names and they'll never come back, and those like cultural norms will never come back, like the binary did not exist in any way, shape or form. And yes, that thing of like now we have to create new practices. And that's just, some of that just falls away. So we had like ancestral, I don't know how to explain this, but like ancestral spiritual leader lines that were like inherited through families. And most of those families were killed off during colonization. So you can imagine what that does to like the spiritual well-being of a people when you lose those families, right? But then in other places, it's been really amazing. And I think it's been part of, like we as Māori have gotten to benefit from the awful learnings of other indigenous communities. And having been colonized more recently, though still very intensively, and even thinking more modern and more modern times in the 80s and 90s, New Zealand was one of the places, if not the place where capitalism, neoliberalism was implemented the fastest and the harshest, and like the dismantling of a social state and that kind of thing, which is another extension of colonization. But yeah, there's definitely benefits to also being like a smaller population, the smaller place. And so like there's ways in which we can access politicians and that kind of thing that I can't even get my head around the scale in the Americas, like of the size and the number of government representatives and stuff like that. I'm like, what the hell? How do you just like message someone and start lobbying them? Like, it's so different here. I'm like, oh, I just meet them in the street, you know, who knows? But yeah, I guess the particular areas that we kind of like gathered around would be like our language was a really big one. It's probably one of the biggest ones, and that's been one of our biggest legacies is, you know, like this idea of the language nest. So from day dot of when a child is born, even before they're born, where they go to school is done in full immersion. And this started in like grandma's garages, just with no money, no pay, just like we're going to put five of our kids, drop them off at grandma's house and just like hope that they can start to absorb some of the language. And that was in the 70s that started. And that kind of snowballed into what's called the Kohanga Reo movement or the language nest movement, which then eventually resulted in an acknowledgement by the Crown that they have a responsibility to protect our language, and that what they do policy-wise does not disproportionately discriminate our practices and our people. So they actually now have to put money into maintaining these schools and these universities and these programs and stuff like that. It's nowhere near the amount they should be.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Are we surprised? Yeah.
We're starting somewhere. Yeah. But things like that. And I remember being blown away when I went to Inari in Finland, in Sapmi territory, and the Finnish Sami parliament president was there, and she's like, and here's our language nests inspired by you guys. And I was just like, what? I'm just like, they're just like down the roof of my house, like, because they become the norm. I forget that they're like so exceptional and so kind of inspirational for other people. And then I think definitely in some of the land protection spaces where we've just like thrown down and occupied, and that's not been easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really violent, you know, times when the military was brought in and that kind of thing, and our big land marches. But then the outcome of that was to create this thing called the Waitangi Tribunal, which is like a treaty court where we can go and we can submit both historic and contemporary claims that the Crown has breached the treaty in this way. And then that tribunal has a responsibility to investigate it, to hear from experts, to figure out all the detailed ways in which it's been breached, and then make recommendations about how the Crown can settle that breach. Again, nowhere near as much as they should be. And there's this like massive loophole, which is that the Crown cannot return private land. It became private because it was stolen.
Yeah. That's a full circle moment.
You're like, we weren't allowed to do that before.
Yamina, okay. So that's been a really complicated process, and it's really hard because it essentially forces our nations to fight each other for how much crumb we want, rather than it being the full reparations of the harm that was done. And of course the incredible Moana Jackson, Māori legal thinker, who was instrumental in things like the drafting of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and those kinds of things. He said, you know, treaties are not meant to be settled, they're meant to be honoured. Mm-hmm. They're a living document that continues to inform our constitutional arrangement. And that's, I think, the space where we're moving into now. And it's just, we're just really lucky to have families and people who've just been like, absolutely not, like, we're done. But often it's like the straw that broke the camel's back, where it's like, this has gone too far, and now we're going to push back. But I remember even like back in the day when I talked about these coercive land sales and that kind of thing, there's these really cool pamphlets that were written by candlelight by like a bunch of my ancestors sitting around a table. They were writing brochures to give to other Māori explaining why land sales were bad, right? So like tried and true campaign tactics since day dot, right? Like those strategizing, you know, using the contemporary tools of the time to try and do the best by our people. And it is hard because I do think there is something about New Zealand where, in terms of like Indigenous politics, we're held up to the rest of the world, but also at the same time it feels very tokenistic. And it's like window dressing while still maintaining the presence of a colonial government. And at the same time being able to recognize the ways in which we do have it good and that we have been able to make progress, but ultimately until the settler state leaves or we find a new arrangement that actually maintains the self-governance of Māori, then it still continues to be window dressing. And it is hard because people will be like, oh, there's so much less racism in New Zealand than Australia, and it's like low bar, okay? It's a low bar. Australia is so racist. Like, being slightly less is not good. And it is very subtle and insidious instead. Like, New Zealand culture is like very conflict averse, it's very laid back, and so the way our racism operates is under like a bit more of a veneer, I guess. Like, I mean, similarly, people compare Canada and the US, like, it's the same thing, it's like still there, same thing, just like better PR basically.
Racism.
I think particularly around our language and our like medicinal practices as well have seen a massive resurgence. And I do look forward to like in the next, we've kind of been laid out a bit of a roadmap towards constitutional transformation in the next couple decades by Moana Jackson, who along with other experts wrote this report to kind of start to inform that conversation. And so I'm hopeful that that will happen, also because it has to happen for the sake of our people and planet. But it's hard to sometimes find it and be like, oh yeah, we won sometimes. And we're still kind of, I'm still alive, so we're still winning.
Big man.
Right? No, it's always beautiful. It's hard because like there's always more that can be done. And then also the acknowledgement of stuff that'll never come back. But it's always like beautiful to like hold that moment to be like, my ancestors would be so proud because like I can still speak the language, there's still parts of the culture that like we've kept going, and like we're still here. So they didn't win,
still scrapping.
Didn't win. they tried. Which leads me to my last question, and then I'm gonna pass it over to Kate after to do our last question.
The real last question.
So basically my last question is, what is there anything more that you think needs to be done? Like, what for you, what would feel like the end goal?
I mean, like, in terms of like the visionary warm fuzzy stuff, it's like that every person who lives here is like safe in their culture and their practices and in their communities. They can be whoever they want and love whoever they want, and we all have what we need to, you know, feed ourselves and nourish ourselves, but also to thrive and find joy. And that be done in a way that adheres to like our legal practices, basically, like our Māori legal and governance practices, because that's what works for everyone and every place. And that ultimately we get to be safe and that we have what we need to be resilient in like the coming really hard times. And I think for me, like the nugget or like the like home example of that is like, so my community is going to have to move because of sea level rise within the next couple of decades, and that should just be okay. Like, ultimately a big environmental disruption like that, pre-colonization, you know, our chiefs, our communities, our leaders, our families would just be like, okay, we'll just pick up and move and we'll identify an appropriate place for us to move to that doesn't displace too many of our, you know, more than human relatives and that kind of thing. And we'll figure this out. We'll do it together. And we'll make sure no one's left behind. Whereas you know, we just had these floods and whole communities have been displaced and our village, like our carved ancestral houses have been, had to be demolished and stuff like that. And these people are like, well, where do we rebuild? Where do we go? Because we've got nowhere else to go. And, you know, pre-colonization, we never built in floodplains anyway, but that's what, where we got displaced to.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. So it's hard because it's like, well, we should just be able to move and we should just be able to relocate. And that, like, ultimately, whatever comes our way in the future, that we have what we need to do that. And that, like, corporations and the crown and the empire can't just keep, like, wreaking havoc mm-hmm. as they like. Because I think a lot about, like, you know, when you do a bad job, so eventually you get fired, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, we've got 200 years of a really bad job. Like, why are we defending this? Why is this the hill that people want to die on? Mm-hmm. Because it's not good. Like, ultimately, it's not good and it's getting worse in some ways, particularly, like, in the realms of inequality and stuff like that. So I'm just like, here we go. Let's pivot. And I think, you know, like I talked earlier about constitutional transformation, I really believe in that. And I also really believe in dismantling capitalism and finding and coming back to what we will call, like, our koha economies based on uplifting and honoring each other. So our gift economies that were always about, like, oh my god, okay, so that person just gave that to me, so now I need to outgift them because, like, otherwise that reflects badly on my honor. And so the currency was honor and prestige, or what mm-hmm. we call mana, right? Your reputation, rather than, like, transactional money currency.
Yeah.
And I think, like, yeah, that's the goal. And you know, it depends on, it's different for each nation, but for mine and for other Māori nations, it is also about what we call manaaki, so, like, hospitality, that, you know, for our Pacific cousins, whoever needs a home has somewhere to come to, and to also thrive and be well in their culture, because we know that that's coming on the horizon too, and, you know, that everyone can be welcome here and can be nourished well. You know, others would say other things, like there are certain people who maybe should leave, but that's that's a discussion for another time. It's a very delicate conversation to have, but I think that's a fair challenge, where it's like, why live in Aotearoa if you don't want to abide by Te Tiriti, like the mm-hmm. treaty and, yeah. and these practices here, and you don't want to respect the land here, yeah. then why stay? You know, if you don't want to treat the land well, then the land won't want to treat you well.
Yeah.
That'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that answered that.
That's a fabulous answer.
Yeah.
That was really good.
That was so
good. Just get out. Gone on a ramble.
Okie dokie.
The real last answer. Question.
Whoa.
I mean, that's correct too. The real last answer.
True. Yeah.
Okay, what are your three favorite things about being Māori?
Ooh, that's like asking, like, what are my three favorite things about, like, existing?
Basically, yeah, that's what we're going for. We want you to have an existential moment.
Yeah, I really, like, I've been asked similar questions before, and I always just, like, short circuit, because it's like, how do I carve pieces of myself mm-hmm. into favorite priorities? I think, first of all, just, like, the values and the, like, the, I guess, yeah, the ancestry of those values, like, being part of a wider family in the Pacific and what that means, like, it's always such a big deal. That's, like, why, like, Stress and I made three different pavlovas to bring you and, like, pick the best one, because it's, like, I have to be the best guest possible.
I must honor my family.
I'm like... And then that's reciprocal, right? It's like, you know, when you come here, I'm like, I have to be the best host possible. And that kind of thing. Like, it gets very stressful. Yeah. I'll be real about that. But it's, you know, that, like, being able to, like, host and receive and share and connect, and that be what binds us together. And to do that from a place of generosity is so, so important. And then, yeah, what's the food. I'll just say it's a bit of a cheat answer, but definitely the food. I mean, we have, like, shared colonial foods, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
spam and corned beef and fry bread.
Good stuff. It's good stuff.
And we all, except our fry bread is a little bit puffier and pillowier than the, like, the flat one. Anyway, we can get into
that. Interesting. Interesting. When we go, yeah, we have to have like a fry bread cook-off.
Yes. I'll watch.
Yeah. But yeah, I think, yeah, just being from where I'm from, like the food and being able to eat from the lands and like having that knowledge to be able to cultivate from the land, but as well as like being really deep relationship with the ocean, and those things as well, I find really rewarding. And it is like this like weird random fact, like when Charles Darwin came here, he said that like our horticultural systems were some of the most advanced he'd ever seen in the world. And oh, so wow. I'm like, yes, we can grow food. Yes. Because you know? There is like, there's this famous Māori movie called Once Were Warriors. Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, Moana Jackson talks about this. He's like, no, actually, the more appropriate thing to say is once we're gardeners. And that's like a really big part of our practices is food. and then, yeah, a third thing. I don't know. Our humor. And when we get in a room and like laugh, you can hear us from like a block down the street. Yeah. Like just the like embracing of joy is really, really important. And that's something that's quite interesting to see for like visitors, particularly like non-Indigenous visitors here. Then when they like suddenly hear like a bunch of Pacifica people, Māori people laugh, they'll be like, whoa. It's just like, yeah, just that joy of gathering and coming together, mm-hmm. and being able to honor each other in that way, mm-hmm. is really cool. Actually, there's so many other things, but also, yeah, that's probably enough. Just it's a good time, mm-hmm. until it's not because of the racists.
Yeah.
That's everywhere. Yep, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason why like we ask that question of like, why do you love yourself indigenously?
Yeah.
You know, what's indigenous, mm-hmm. self-love?
And my favorite thing is like almost everybody's answer is the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And being like, we all have anti-laughs. Every group has like some really loud laughs, and just it scares the non-indigenous people.
Scares the neighbors.
Yeah.
And pretty much. Everyone has great food, mm-hmm. and everyone just like really enjoys like how much connection to each other is very important. And I think that's just beautiful to know like that we all have that in common. Mm-hmm. We all have a lot of pain in common, but we also have like things just like that are so joyous and beautiful in common as well.
The ideas of kinship and mm-hmm. relatives.
Yeah. And that being said, just saying, anyone's welcome to come visit. It's also so rare to have friends come and visit from overseas because we're so far away from anywhere.
We're trying.
It's like,
I'm not gonna lie to you.
We thought we were trying to book.
We'll make it happen. Mm-hmm. We'll make it happen. Yeah, it's a good time. I'm biased, but it's a good time.
That's fair. So we just can't bring our cats with us. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so sorry. That's more paperwork.
Yeah. It was actually it was Captain Cook who released the first pair of cats into the environment. So it's complicated, right?
You're like, I hate him, but I love cats.
And he just let them go. He just wrote in his diary, just they were gone.
Oh my gosh.
Put them in the bush.
That's nuts.
Here there's the birds are so odd because there's no natural predators. Mm. Instead of mammals, we got birds and we got some bats. And that's it. There's no like when I came over to your guys' way, I was like, sorry, what? I'm gonna have to carry a knife. Like, what?
There's cougars.
raccoons.
Raccoons. They're like wolves, bears. I was like, sorry, what? We don't have to worry about anything here until like rats and stoats and ferrets and cats were introduced. And it's that's part of it as well, is just like restoring those ecosystems too, because this is the only part of the entire world where a lot of these animals live. And mm-hmm. it's nice, and that's like we're starting to make really good progress on that, but Yeah, they're our favorite little buddies, our little fat birds eating berries.
Yeah.
So adorable. But yeah, no cats, unfortunately, even though, you know, we are bound together through ancestry going back like 8,000 years. So they do need to be taken care of.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Run free, cat.
I'm going to use that later on somebody.
Yeah. You're like, did they have names?
They had names. I'll have to like figure that, find them out.
Please find them and send it to us.
Oh, they're probably ridiculous too.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We'll put it in the podcast description.
Yeah. Love it.
Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I know that everyone's going to be super excited to learn, and it's just, it's always great to hang out with you in general. So.
Thank you for having me. This has been really lovely, and yeah, so cool that you guys are making space for these conversations as well across like international spaces. Yeah. There's always so much to learn from each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're just doing nation-to-nation building.
Yeah.
From our living room.
Yep.
Yep.
Keeping it humble. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Shall I take us home?
Take us home.
All right.
Take us to the kitchen.
We are so happy that you are all able to join us and listening. Where can they find us?
You can find us on Spotify. I'm talking Apple Podcasts. I'm talking Google Podcasts.
I think so.
I feel like that's false advertisement.
Pocket Podcasts?
Pocket Podcasts.
Honestly.
Our website.
Yeah. Our website.
Go to our website.
SpillingTea.ca. You can buy merch.
You can buy merch.
There's merch.
India, we'll merch.
We'll tell you about merch.
We'll
send you some merch. I love some merch.
You can also follow us on Instagram or TikTok at Spilling Lab Tea Under Cedar Trees.
Yep.
And as always, if you could follow us, like, subscribe,
and now
rate us. Spotify. I can't do it. I can't listen to these episodes. I have to listen to them like when we do editing. I'm not doing it to try to rate us, because that's also weird that I would be rating us. But yeah, so thank you for joining us, and we have more episodes to come. See you later.
See you later.
Namaltis.